In 2016, a tragedy occurred in the Holton family. At some point, the city sheriff left the property, leaving Michael, his wife April, and their son Madison there. He had been called in as the boy had held a drug-fueled party at the family home while the parents were away. Madison had been handcuffed by his father before the sheriff arrived and remained that way when he left. But 11 minutes later, Michael and April were found lifeless on the bedroom floor after gunshots were heard. The only witness and suspect was Madison, who was still handcuffed. What happened in those 11 minutes? April Diane Holton, born December 24th, 78, and Jesse Michael Holton, born June 3rd, 79, became close when they were both seniors in high school. They fell in love very quickly and decided to get married before they even turned 20. Together, the couple had three children, Jesse Madison, Hayden, and Kyle. Note that the father's name is Jesse Michael and the son is Jesse Madison. So, to make it easier, I will address each one by their second name. Father, Michael, and son, Madison. Michael became a firefighter, eventually serving as chief of the fire department in the town where they lived, Eclectic, Alabama. He traveled to New York as a volunteer after the 9/11 attacks and helped many families there. He was also mayor of Eclectic from 2012 to 2014. April was a member of First Baptist Church of Eclectic since childhood. She was active in the youth mission, serving as a team mother. The couple dedicated their lives to serving people and their community. They were considered to be upstanding members of their community. Madison was the eldest child, born in 1999. In his childhood and adolescence, he was friendly and social. At school, he was the funniest in his class. But, like practically all teenagers, he was starting to be a problem, getting in fights and using drugs. In 2015 and 2016, perhaps all the pressure from the family turmoil caused April and Michael's relationship to go into crisis. April then filed for divorce against Michael's wishes in the first half of 2016. While the process was ongoing, April left home and took her two youngest children, leaving only Madison, age 17, living with his father. On the afternoon of Sunday, September 11th, 2016, Michael answered a call from a man who said his son had just arrived home drunk and drugged after a party at Michael's house. He wanted to know what was going on there, but Michael was at work and he knew nothing about it. The man was extremely irate and told Michael to check it out and to tell Madison not to contact his son again. Michael returned home and found a party in full swing inside the property. He ordered everyone to leave and had a serious argument with his son, claiming that this type of behavior was ruining his reputation in the city. Michael called the boy's mother, asking her to come over immediately, because he, perhaps worried about his image in the community, was calling Bill Franklin, an acquaintance and the local sheriff, to take legal action against his own son. When the sheriff arrived, Michael approached him at the door, warning him that he had handcuffed his son to discipline him, but not to worry. He said he wanted to know how to document paperwork to get him and his son in front of a judge so they could talk about the problems he was having with the boy. When the sheriff entered, Madison was sitting on the couch. His mother April was next to him, unsure what to do next. The fact that the boy, a minor, had been partying with alcohol and drugs was indeed wrong and illegal, but handcuffing him inside his own house seemed a bit much to her. So the adults arranged for Madison to appear at the police station the next morning, Monday. The sheriff and his support left at 4:48 p.m. However, just 11 minutes later, at 4:59, the 911 center received a call. This time from Michael's neighbor, saying Madison had just arrived at his house, handcuffed and hysterical. He said his father was attacking his mother and threatening her. Police authorities headed to the family's home, but when police arrived at the scene minutes later, they found both April and Michael lying on the floor of a bedroom with a gun between them. Michael had a gunshot wound to the back of the head, was pronounced dead at the scene. April, who despite also being shot in the head, was still breathing. She was taken to hospital, but unfortunately, she passed away the next day. The police, insisting that all of this was done by a third person, set their sights on the only person who was alive in the house, Madison. Even though he had been handcuffed, with his hands behind his back the entire time, he was still considered to be the only suspect. The local sheriff believed that Madison had not accepted his impending punishment for his delinquent behavior, and that at some point in those 11 minutes, he had managed to get the key to the handcuffs, remove them, shoot his mother and father, then handcuff himself again before asking the neighbor for help. The coroner's report made the authorities believe even more that Madison was responsible. Michael died from a wound inflicted near the base of his skull on the left side. Investigators said the gun appeared to be aimed from below due to the trajectory of the wound. The bullet entered the back left side and exited the right front, but Michael was right-handed, meaning the police thought it was unlikely that he shot himself in the back of the head on the left side. April had a gunshot wound to one of the fingers on her right hand, consistent with a defensive wound. The same hand was covering the upper right part of her head when she was found. The medical examiner who performed both autopsies characterized the injuries as close contact wounds. Although the pathologist classified the deaths as homicides, they could not rule out the possibility that it was the result of a murder-suicide. During the interrogation, Sheriff Bill invited Mike, the boy's uncle, to be present as Madison was a minor. Madison explained that his parents fought a lot and things had gotten worse and worse. He said that the fights were verbal. Sometimes there was a tense atmosphere in the house when they didn't speak to each other. He was waiting to finish school so he could go to college and leave home. He added that when his parents separated, Michael discovered that April had a new boyfriend and that this was very painful to him. His father often cried in the house and said that he couldn't live without his wife.
There's a reason he's in here, okay? He's got your best interest at heart.
My dad, signaled my mom to come into the room, and she did, and he shut the door.
After about 5 minutes, you say you heard your mom?
Scream help.
Scream help. Okay, what did you do?
I jumped up. I ran to the master bedroom door. I kicked it open, and my dad was holding her like this. I was like, I need to go get help. And then I sprinted, screaming help, to my neighbor's house.
Will you agree with me that there was a gunshot fired?
I mean, that as of what I've been told, yes.
But you never heard that?
No, sir.
Do you feel like any of this is on you?
I don't know. I didn't hurt either of my parents.
No.
The doctor down there says they didn't shoot themselves.
I don't care what the doctor says. I didn't shoot my parents.
Uncle Mike tried to talk to Madison. He put it to Madison that he may have shot his father to protect his mother and accidentally shot her too. But Madison stuck to his story.
This will be the only time that if your story is any different than what you told him, just listen to me. If it's any different. Okay? Now's the time to tell him. Let's say you walked in there and your dad's got your mama by the throat and you did what you thought you had to do.
I've already told y'all everything that I know. I've told y'all everything that I know.
When the sheriff and the uncle finished talking and were leaving the interrogation room, he made an obscene gesture as they closed the door. Madison, then 17, was being held as a suspect on two counts of murder, and the sheriff's office filed paperwork requesting that he be tried as an adult to face the maximum sentence of life in prison for each death. Days later, while in prison, talking to a visitor, his concerns about his incarceration seemed unusual.
What if, like, all the girls said about him? Like, that's what I wondered. Like, the people I slept with, like, what do they think about it right now? Like, oh, damn, I'm a murderer.
While he was awaiting trial, being investigated and interrogated, he never changed his version of events. The story was always the same. He wanted to take a polygraph test to prove he was not lying.
I just want to be set up for a polygraph test, okay. Honestly.
All
right. Like, as soon as y'all can do it, I want a polygraph test.
Okay.
Hey, você se interessa por crimes reais, serial killers, coisas macabras e tem um senso de humor um tanto quanto sórdido? Se sim, você não está sozinho.
Se você precisa de um lugar recheado de pessoas como você, venha conhecer o podcast Pátria Amada Criminal.
Todas as semanas, tentamos entender o pior da humanidade.
Nesse processo, a gente ri, chora, fica brava, fofoca. Porque, afinal de contas, é assim que a gente fala quando está entre amigos.
Suas novas melhores amigas trevosas estão aqui, no Pátria Amada Criminal.
Normally, investigators ask suspects if they want to take the test, and they accept or not. But the fact that the request came from the prisoner was rare. If guilty, a suspect would not risk facing the machine. However, the test never took place. As time passed, April's family began to believe that the boy was possibly telling the truth. Uncle Mike began donating part of his time to a private investigation, looking for clues that could lead to an answer that would further confirm the sheriff's office's accusations, or at least raise doubts about those accusations. Mike found a diary of his brother-in-law where he shared something with his wife. April, I love you more than you will ever know. I just can't go on knowing you're with somebody else. I know you'll say I'm being selfish, but it was either me or the both of us. The boys need you. You are a great mother. I'm sorry it ended like it did. I love you. In the autopsy reports, Michael's toxicological results identified high dosages of the drugs hydrocodone, oxycodone, and Traumadol in his body. These medications are used to treat severe pain in the body and can only be used under medical prescription. Michael did not have a prescription for any of these. It was clear to Mike that his brother-in-law had been psychologically unwell. Mike also saw in the reports that Michael's skin was found under April's nails and that he had nail scratches on his face. In the forensic report, he read that the gun only contained Michael's DNA. And with that, he asked, "If my nephew really shot his parents, in close contact, where are the splashes of the victim's blood on his body and the gunpowder from the fired bullets?" He couldn't find any answers in the report. His question reminded me a lot of a case that I already presented here on the channel, the Sandra Garner case, where she reported that a stranger entered the property and shot her husband. But as soon as she arrived at the police station to give a statement, she had her hands examined and clothes removed to be sent for laboratory analysis. All before the officer's first question. And that did not happen with Madison. This doubt persisted for almost a year and a half, and so, after 17 months, in February 2018, Mike and his wife took out a loan and paid the boy's bail so he could await his trial in freedom. The family now needed to highlight the doubts surrounding the case and to prevent the sheriff's office from pushing forward with their certainty of Madison's guilt. With the help of the local church in raising funds, the family hired experts and began to file and monitor the case. The trial hearings began later that year, and all the facts presented here were covered in detail. On October 22nd, 2018, the last day of the trial, the public prosecutor's office made a statement before the hearing, stating that they were dropping all charges against Madison. District Attorney Randall Houston said the following.
Did not believe 100% was guilty. I've never put anyone in prison that I did not believe 100% deserved to be in prison. And I've never been confronted with a situation like this, where as a prosecutor, my prosecutor did not believe that it was ethical to go forward with the charges. He was concerned that if Jesse were found guilty, that it could not be undone. And as you know, murder charges have no statute of limitations. So if evidence ever develops otherwise to show and to convince us beyond a reasonable doubt that we could prove it beyond a reasonable doubt, then of course the murder charges could be reinstated.
Was there any evidence early along that kind of gave you all concern that this may not play up to be what you had anticipated? Because initially he was only indicted on one count, and then you put it back before another grand jury and so forth. I mean, the case has been atypical from the beginning.
It's been a difficult case from the beginning, I can say that. However, originally, the sheriff's office was informed by the Department of Forensic Sciences that this was a homicide. It is classified on the death certificate as a homicide. And I think that's based on the unusual positioning of the bullet wound. Designation as a homicide has not changed. However, in preparing the case for trial, in our discussions with the Department of Forensic Sciences, the most they could say was it's more likely than not a homicide based on the location and trajectory of the bullet wound. It's more likely than not. It's not unusual. That is not unusual in a murder case. And normally, there is additional evidence that supports that from the Department of Forensic Sciences. In this case, that did not exist. In this case, for the last month, we've been looking into it, trying to support the theory that this was a murder. And normally, you would have blood splatter, you would have DNA, you might have fingerprints, any number of things. That did not occur in this case. We did have fingerprints, but they were not Jesse Holton's fingerprints. There was blood splatter, but none of it was on Jesse. There was no blood splatter at all on him. We had Jesse engaging in unusual behavior. Now for him, I don't know if he's just a weird kid, I don't know what it was, but he did some unusual things, which led investigators to question what he was saying and what his motives were. However, at the end of the day, the forensics evidence that we received was more consistent with Jesse's story than it was with murder.
Therefore, Jesse Madison was free. Not because he was proved innocent, but because it was not possible to find evidence that he was guilty.
Hey! Você se interessa por crimes reais, serial killers, coisas macabras e tem um senso de humor um tanto quanto sórdido? Se sim, você não está sozinho.
Se você precisa de um lugar recheado de pessoas como você, venha conhecer o podcast Pátria Amada Criminal.
Todas as semanas tentamos entender o pior da humanidade.
Nesse processo a gente ri, chora, fica brava, fofoca, porque afinal de contas é assim que a gente fala quando está entre amigos.
Suas novas melhores amigas trevosas estão aqui, no Pátria Amada Criminal.